This is the Reason Podcast, and I'm your host, Nick Gillespie. Did you weigh yourself this morning? I did. When you got to work, did you check any performance measures from the day before? I did. I always look at what sort of web traffic I got at Reason.com the previous day. If you're a supervisor at work, are you constantly crunching numbers about the people who report to you and sending analysis up the chain of command? I used to before I became an editor at large, and I no longer have to. When you go home from work, do you check your kids' school grades on Progress Book or some other kind of online tracking system? Yeah, I used to do that too when my kids were little. Before you go to sleep, did you get your 10,000 steps in? Or are you waving your arms on the couch right now trying to goose the total before you finally turn in for the night? We live in an age of what might be called intense measurements or metric fixation. Virtually everything we do yields tons of data, numbers, information that we try to use to improve our performance, make sense of the world, hold people accountable, or figure out if we're doing things right. Even just a few decades ago, this would have struck most of us as absolutely nuts, but now we take it for granted at home, at work, at play. My guest today is historian Jerry Z. Mueller, who teaches at Catholic University and is the author most recently of The Tyranny of Metrics, which was published last year by Princeton University Press and has just come out in paperback. Go to Amazon or your local bookstore, pick up a copy. He's got a lot of things to say about our obsession with measuring stuff, and I don't know how to measure it exactly, but he brings a lot of wisdom to the discussion. Jerry Mueller, thanks for talking with Reason.
Pleasure to be with you, Nick.
So give me the elevator pitch version of your book.
So the elevator pitch is that there's a kind of organizational culture that has become almost omnipresent in our society, and a wide range of organizations in business, in K-12 education, in higher education, in government, in medicine, in philanthropy, and other areas too. And it's based on the premise that human judgment, that is to say, judgment that's based on experience and on talent, is unreliable. And so a much more reliable form, one that does away with bias and the particularities of individuals, is standardized measurement. That's the first of the three elements of what I've called metric fixation, that judgment is unreliable, so replace it with standardized measurement. You're probably familiar with the dictum from a stack of managerial books that what gets measured gets done. The second premise is that people respond to incentives, so you ought to reward them if they meet their metric targets, that is their standardized measurements, and you ought to punish them if they don't. And that reward can be either in the form of monetary reward, so essentially pay for performance, or it can be reputational in the form of, say, scorecards for surgeons or rankings for universities. So that's the second premise, is that people respond to incentives, so you should reward and punish them based on these standardized metrics. And the third premise is that of what's sometimes called accountability or transparency. And this is the notion that making these standardized measures public will make individual practitioners or whole institutions more responsive and responsible. So each of these ideas, standardized measurement, reward and punishment, transparency and accountability, each of them sound plausible and have a certain plausible logic to them. But when they're actually instituted in combination in the real world, they often turn out to be dysfunctional. They don't work. They demotivate people. They create dysfunctions within institutions. And that's what my book is about, why those seemingly rational premises, which have come to permeate more and more of our organizational cultures, often turn out to be dysfunctional and oppressive in ways that the book analyzes and describes, and then shows you in a variety of fields examples of how this dysfunction occurs, and then offer some suggestions for the proper ways to use measurement.
Okay. And we're going to go through some of those case studies in a minute. What I'd like to do is to kind of talk with you about why now? Why has the desire for metrics kicked up so much? You know, at one point in the book, you say that there's an interesting connection between seemingly objective measurements, mm-hmm. a desire for that, and the loss of trust. Mm-hmm. You say the demand for measured accountability and transparency waxes as trust wanes. What do you mean by that?
I mean that as people have become more and more suspicious or distrustful of institutions, they seek some sort of certifiable knowledge that will provide them with a substitute for trust. In other words, they seek reliable knowledge. And numbers give the appearance of being objective and mm-hmm. reliable, though the way in which they come about may not be right. reliable at all, but they give that appearance. And so people are on the lookout for evidence, seemingly objective, seemingly scientific evidence, that their institutions are actually responsive or reliable, be mm-hmm. they hospitals or doctors or universities or government institutions.
Right.
There's been a general suspicion of institutions. Some of it goes back to, has a variety of sources. Some of it goes back to a kind of general suspicion of authority that became so dominant in the 1960s and continued in some ways. Some of it has to do with a kind of libertarian suspicion of institutions as engaged in constant self-dealing. Some of it has to do with the notion of the unreliable, the principal agent problem, as economists formulated. That is,
would you briefly describe that?
Sure. The notion is that the principals, that is, those who own an organization or are in some superior position in the organization, so say the stockholders, have to be concerned with what the people that they hire, that is, their agents, are doing, and have to be suspicious of the fact that those agents may be engaged in various forms of self-dealing. So the question is, how can the principals, so the stockholders or the trustees of the university or whatever, how can they be sure that their agents, their subordinates, are actually carrying out the purposes of the principals? And the standard answer is some form of monitoring or surveillance, so that the principals can find out what the agents are doing, and some form of pay for performance, that is, reward and punishment. Mm-hmm. And this is a doctrine that was promulgated first in business schools and then became ever more omnipresent in the world of business. So these sources of distrust come from a variety of cultural sources, of political mm-hmm. ideologies, of academic academic theories like principal agent theories. And then, of course, there's a whole field, a burgeoning field of behavioral psychology and behavioral economics, much of which is focused on the way in which we have a tendency to miscalculate numbers. And mm-hmm. all of those together create this distrust. So that's one source of it. A second source is what you might call managerialism. That is the notion that one finds promulgated in business schools and beyond, mm-hmm. that management is a kind of set of techniques that one can learn, a set of standardized techniques that you can learn. And then once you've learned those techniques, many of which have to do with metric fixation, you can then apply them to any kind of organization. So you don't really need deep experience in a particular field or a particular organization. You just really need to know these managerial techniques, which are rather readily taught. And as I say, these techniques Right. tend to be abstract, metrically oriented, and so on. And then the third source, I would say, is what you might broadly call, to take a term from Friedrich Hayek, scientism. The notion that all of reality, including social reality, is analogous in some ways to physics and the movement of inanimate object inanimate objects, and that one can find formulas that will mathematical formulas that will predict the way in which people will respond, just as atoms will respond, and one can therefore mm-hmm. plan an economy or plan a whole corporation. That's also a form of scientism. So that notion, too, that people and social organizations are manipulable in the way that the physical universe is, and that we can use the same kind of mathematical methods for understanding and controlling them, that's another cultural propensity that feeds into metric fixation.
And of course, Hayek would, he elaborates on scientism, particularly in the Counter-Revolution of Science, mm-hmm. Studies on the abuses of reason. And he's talking particularly about how he locates a lot of this coming out of the French Enlightenment, particularly the French Revolution. In your book, you talk about how a lot of this goes back to the 19th century, or maybe not, but it's recognizable in the mid-19th century. Talk about what was going on with British schools, because it was fascinating to me. We're going to talk about K-12 education in a second, mm-hmm. but the way that we all talk about, you know, we want these particular metrics and we want test scores and we want graduation rates and all of these seemingly, as you were saying, kind of objective facts, which get mushy the minute you start to kind of poke them or prod them. But a bunch of this stuff it was happening, you know, 150 years ago in British schools. What was going on then?
Yes, and it comes out of the same kind of economistic mentality that we're talking about in regard to metric fixation. So some time ago, I wrote a book called The Mind and the Market on capitalism in modern European thought, and there was a chapter there on the great British poet and cultural critic of the 1860s and 70s, Matthew Arnold. And that's when I came across this case of educational reform in the 19th century. Matthew Arnold is best known as a poet and also as a cultural critic, but his day job was as an inspector of schools. So he really knew about that. And in the...
That's when he first started talking about the ignorant armies of the night clashing, right?
Around that time, yes. Yes. And there was a legislator by the name of Robert Lowe, who actually plays a rather important role in the legal history of capitalism because he helped develop a couple of parliamentary acts that made it easier to create corporations. And that was actually a big contribution. But then he took that kind of mentality. And when he was in the Department of Education, he tried to apply a kind of economistic mentality to schools. And the notion was that in what we would call K-12 education, each year an inspector would inspect each school and he would examine each student and see and check on their level of arithmetic knowledge and their level of reading knowledge. And he would grade the school or give it a numeric evaluation accordingly. And schools that did not meet the standard or were subpar would have some of their revenue taken from them by the Department of Education. So all of the premises and assumptions of metric fixation are mm-hmm. already there in that Act of Parliament by Robert Lowe. And Matthew Arnold, who, as I say, had real experience in this field, said, look, this isn't going to work for a couple of reasons. First of all, not all the students will show up, and especially the poorer ones and so on won't show up, and they'll be penalized for that. Secondly, the teachers will teach towards what's getting tested. They'll teach a narrow slice mm-hmm. of mathematics, and they'll teach a narrow slice of English in a way that will not arouse the curiosity and interests of the students. So he said, all of this is going to be counterproductive. And they put it into practice, and after a decade or two, they abandoned it, more or less precisely for the reasons that Matthew Arnold had predicted. So this was a precursor in the second third of the 19th century, or the last part of the 19th century, of this notion of metric fixation as applies to public institutions in general and education in particular.
Yeah, it sounds so contemporary, obviously. You write about Campbell's Law and Goodhart's Law, mm-hmm. and they kind of come into play here.
Yeah.
What are they, and how do they bear on a discussion about metrics?
Yeah. So these were two laws that overlapped to a great degree that were formulated around the same time in the early 1970s by two thinkers on opposite sides of the Atlantic. Campbell was a professor of social psychology at Northwestern. And the law, as he formulated it, was the more any quantitative social indicator is used for social decision-making, the more subject it will be to corruption pressures, and the more it will distort the processes it is intended to measure. That was his version of it.
Right.
Goodhart was a British economist and civil servant. His version is any measure used for control is unreliable. So to put it another way, anything that is measured and rewarded will be gamed. And that's, of course, one of the big themes of my book, The Tyranny of Metrics.
Right. But you are also at pains to say that you're not against measurement and you're not against metrics, right?
For sure.
Yeah. So let's go through a couple of case studies that you lay out in the book and kind of explain what's going wrong. And I guess we were talking about, you know, the equivalent of K-12 education in 19th century England. Talk about it in contemporary times, like, you know, and this is a just an area where there is so much, there are so many numbers that get bruited about all of the time in every conversation about K-12 education. What are we missing by measuring, you know, so much student activity or teacher activity as well?
Well, we're missing the way in which the combination of measuring, transparency to outside parties, and mm-hmm. reward and punishment creates all kinds of incentives for gaming and dysfunction. So a lot of this was embodied, for example, in No Child Left Behind, which was legislation that was adopted early in the George W. Bush administration. It was in some ways a continuation and intensification of trends that were already going on in the previous Clinton administration. And it had political buy-in from both Republicans and Democrats.
Yep.
Right. That's one of the interesting mm-hmm. things about this metric fixation in government, is that it seems to transcend party and ideological propensities. And the notion of the main motivation behind No Child Left Behind was the notion that there was an achievement gap. Above all, at the time, people were concerned about the gap between white students and African-American students. There was also the category of Asians and Hispanics, which became more important as that population grew. And the notion was that because there was this gap, it was a problem, so it was a perceived problem at least, and the notion was you were going to solve it by creating these metric tools so that you were going to measure students through standardized tests in third grade and eighth grade and towards the end of high school, and you were going to make those grades or those metric measurements public. And you were going to reward and especially punish schools that didn't live up to the desired targets. And, you know, as I say, each of those premises seem plausible when you first hear them. What actually happened was a few things. First of all, after many years of this having been instituted, and by the way, when the Obama administration came in, they doubled down on this in Race to the Top. In addition to rewarding and punishing individual schools, they want to actually reward and punish individual teachers. So in terms of the achievement gap between whites and blacks, after 15 or 20 years of this process, there was more or less absolutely no change. Asians pulled ahead a little bit more, but the gap between whites, Hispanics, and blacks remained the same. So on that level, it was entirely a failure. But it created all sorts of dysfunctions, and let me just mention a few of them. One of them is that especially in schools that were marginal, that is to say that had weaker students, but to some degree even in schools that were stronger, that had better students, it created a tremendous incentive for teachers to teach to the test. That is to only teach or primarily teach those parts of English and those parts of mathematics which are actually tested on the test. So, for example, college professors will tell you now that their students know how to write a five-paragraph paper because that's what they're taught to prepare for these tests in high school, but they don't know how to write a longer paper. They know how to write how to read a passage of several paragraphs, but they don't know how to, God forbid, read a novel or a play, because those are the kinds of things that are not tested. So first of all, only a small part of the discipline in question gets tested, gets taught, or at least gets focused upon. Secondly, other important elements of education that aren't tested tend not to be taught. So there was much diminished attention to art and music and history and other fields that don't get taught, but that don't get tested and rewarded, but that are important for people's general knowledge and for their psychosocial development. So that was one problem, was sort of the narrowing of focus. And then there was the fact that teachers, by and large, didn't like this. That is to say, it was demotivating for them to have to teach to the test. Thirdly, there was a lot of gaming, that is, trying to reach the metric targets in ways that were at odds with the actual purpose of the targets.
I think you're being gentle by calling it gaming, right? I mean, there was it ranged from outright fraud to, you know, where there were scandals where people faked test scores. To holding back students from taking the test,
right,
if they would.
Right, that's a...
They took, all the dumb kids were told to take a day off, right?
Yes, or students who were weak were classified as disabled in one way or another so that they wouldn't be part of the testing procedure,
right,
and their scores wouldn't count towards these metrics.
But isn't it true, though? I mean, one of the things that you point out in the book, and Reason, you know, probably talks about this every week of the year, but in what's called the Nation's Report Card, the National Assessment of Educational Progress, we now know, though, I mean, partly because of metrics, we know that graduating high school seniors, despite spending much more money per pupil over the past 20, 30, 40 years, they don't perform any better on the tests. Isn't that kind of worth knowing?
It is worth knowing up to a point, but then if you just keep testing beyond that, once you know that,
right,
then it becomes wasteful and counterproductive.
I see. Yeah. And how do you, you know, in something like education, how do you get at what's happening in the classroom outside of kind of measurements like the ones that we're talking about? And you're kind of saying, yeah, you know, they're really not that valuable.
Well, I'd say two things. First of all, I want to point out that much of what happens in the classroom in terms of education depends on factors from outside the classroom. That is, what's the nature of the familial background and cultural propensities that the students bring into the classroom? That's usually far more determinative than anything that happens in the classroom. And we know, since at least the report by James Coleman in 1966 on American education, that, you know, the greatest predictor of how students will do, or how a school will perform, is the nature of their parents. And so there are limits to what can be done in the classroom. Now, of course, this is not a gospel of despair. Things can be done,
right,
in the classroom, but that can be done by mutual observation of teachers of one another, or by more skilled teachers of less skilled teachers, or more successful teachers of less successful teachers. All of those are ways of doing it.
I was very, I was surprised and kind of comforted to see that even in 19th century Britain, that they were trying to get at what the teachers added to the students' knowledge. And you know, I realize we're still trying to do that, to figure out, because people do recognize that stuff outside the classroom is far more important. So they're trying to measure whether or not the teacher actually is effective or not. But I guess that's much, much harder to do than it seems.
Yes, and even then, when you're trying to measure the value added, that is the... You assume that students come in with different levels of knowledge, and then you try to measure the incremental change in knowledge from the beginning of the year to the end of the year. Even then, the speed with which students pick up knowledge depends in large part on factors outside of the classroom as well.
Would you talk about, you begin the book, actually, you're bitching and moaning about all of the reports that you have to do as an academic now, because at the college and university level, there's a lot more reporting going on. And you seem a little bit cranky about that. You know, what's going on at the college level that you think is drawing attention and energy away from where it should be focused to kind of useless exercises in numbers gathering and crunching?
Yeah. Well, the same person who was sort of the brains behind, the policy brains behind No Child Left Behind, Margaret Spellings, also convened a conference on higher education.
So she's your Professor Moriarty, right? She has somehow made your life miserable. She was Bush's Secretary of Education for a while, but
yeah,
please continue.
Yeah, I would say that she's sort of the Robert, she is to education what Robert McNamara was to defense. and she convened this conference on higher education, and their conclusion was that one needed more assessment. And one needed more performance measures. So this then filtered down to the regional associations that accredit colleges and universities. And that and their demands in turn filtered down to the university administration. And eventually those demands from the university administration, as I say, imposed upon them from above, came down to the level of departmental chairs. And during this time, I was a departmental chair. Now, it's one of those cases where one's sort of larger and long-term interests, in this case, my interests in public policy and so on, come together with a particular personal experience that acts as a kind of spark to think about what are the larger reasons for this process that's going on in my own institution that I'm dissatisfied with. And I was dissatisfied with it because I was chair of the department. I was doing, I thought, a reasonably good job of the kinds of things that chairs ought to be doing in terms of hiring good faculty and fostering my colleagues and making sure the right sort of courses were taught. And then there were more and more demands for data, some of which was useful, but much of which was not useful. And when I asked the provost of the university at the time, why are we gathering this? He said, I don't know. But the Association of Colleges and Universities, the Middle States Association, says we have to do it. And then I found out that the Middle States Association said we have to do it because the Department of Education said we have to do it. Mm. And then as I pulled back my aperture further and further, or opened it wider and wider, I saw that indeed the Department of Education was responding to this much larger organizational culture of this belief in standardized performance metrics. That's how it first came about.
And what were they, what kinds of reports were you compiling that you were just like, you know, this is a waste of time?
Well, we had always had a standard method of keeping track of how our graduating seniors in our department were doing. And that is every student, all of our seniors had to do a senior paper and be part of a senior seminar. And we had a system of keeping track of that. It was called grades, A, B, C, D, F. Yeah. Now there was a new system of rubrics that was different, that was supposed to be different than grades, that had a more intricate set of criteria. And we were supposed to submit this year after year, but nobody really paid attention to changes. There actually weren't very many changes from year to year. And these rubrics were no more accurate and no more effective than our previous system of simply giving grades. So that was one example among many of these kinds of what seemed to me to be useless metrics that were taking up time of people in the department, and were just indicative, as I say, of this larger trend.
Yeah, and at one point you say inputs and outputs can be measured more easily. So what is the relationship between a kind of metric fixation at the university level and a kind of proliferation of publishing?
A metric fixation at the university level, it appears on that level of faculty, and it appears even more so in the phenomenon school rankings and university-wide rankings. So when it comes to faculty pay raises and promotions, one of the things that universities especially research universities, legitimately pay attention to is publication. But then the question is, how are publications to be evaluated? And one of the ways that's become ever more standard is to go to one of these commercial databases that keeps track of publications in periodicals, in scholarly periodicals, and we'll spit out the number of publications per scholar, and we'll now spit out also the so-called impact value of the journals in which they publish. So this is problematic. I mean, it can be useful to have this as a counterweight to the bias that the superior, that is the department chair or the dean or the provost might mm-hmm. have, but it has to be used with judgment. And among the factors that come into play in judgment is the question of how significant is this publication? How useful is the database? So, for example, in almost all of the natural sciences and in some of the behavioral sciences, the way in which new knowledge is promulgated is primarily through published journal articles. But in some fields, like mine, history, new knowledge is often promulgated in the form of books. Well, these databases mm-hmm. don't take books into account. And so if you have a dean or a provost who's a natural scientist and is used to using this system of metric evaluation, he or she may simply overlook or be unaware of what are the really significant forms of publication in the field. And then there's the fact that these databases are deliberately quite narrowly formulated. That is to say, they take into account only journals in a particular field, say, psychology or sociology or political science or what have you. But if you write a book that is in some ways transdisciplinary, like, say, The Tyranny of Metrics, it doesn't count if it gets reviewed in, you know, if you're a historian and it gets reviewed in a political science journal or an economics right. journal or Nature. That doesn't count.
The world is just beating your ass, isn't it, Jerry Mueller? And of course, the great dream, one of the great dreams of the past 20 or 30 years in the academy is to be precisely interdisciplinary. Mm-hmm. And yet, in a weird way, you're being pushed to do that, and then you're not really being rewarded if you actually are truly interdisciplinary.
Right.
Tell me this.
Let me mention a couple of other ways. There's increasing emphasis in many universities on student evaluations of teachers, of professors, mm-hmm. as a way of evaluating teaching. Well, there's something to be said for that, but it can also be highly distortive. I've heard from a number of junior faculty members at universities in different countries that now have this kind of system, that they are told by their senior colleagues not to put too much reading on the reading lists, on the required reading lists, because then the students will complain and give the professors lower ratings on their student evaluations, and that will
now
then affect their tenures.
Well, now it seems like you're just special pleading, right? Because you're a bad teacher, so you get upset when you get bad teaching evaluations, right?
Right. So
no, but yeah. But this is, I mean, what you're saying here is that, I mean, it's not that that isn't useful information or it can be useful information, but that when you take one number or one metric and you make that the thing that everybody is working towards, it gets distorted in all kinds of common sense and judgment and a broader picture of what's going on just kind of goes out the window.
Exactly. And that's where the role of judgment comes in, judgment based mm-hmm. upon experience and talent. Because a department head who has some experience and knowledge of the teaching talents or lack thereof of particular faculty members, he can look at some negative set of numbers and discuss it with the faculty member in question mm-hmm. To find out what happened. Now, it may be that there's a genuine problem, especially if there's mm-hmm. a recurrence of a pattern of low numbers. But it may be that there are extenuating circumstances. And that's where, as I say, metrics are useful, but they have to be to be used properly. Right. They have to be combined with judgment based on experience and talent.
Just to kind of skip around a little mm-hmm. bit, in the section on medicine, mm-hmm. I thought it was really interesting. You kind of talk about how evaluating or kind of creating scorecards for surgeons in particular has had a bad effect. What was that effect? And, you know, why didn't people see it coming?
People didn't see it coming because of their naivete about scientism and economism and managerialism. Right. So here's what happened. A number of states started to institute scorecards for surgeons who were engaged in various kinds of standardized procedures like knee replacements or heart surgery. And these scorecards were to be made, not they were just weren't to be made, they actually were made public. That is, they were put online. And they indicated the rate of success of the surgeon as measured in various ways, usually by for serious things like heart operations, for 30-day survival. So now the reputation of the surgeon depended upon these metrics. So what did some surgeons do? They started to turn down patients who were more risky, where the chances were that the surgery was not going to be successful, say because the patient had a lot of comorbidities, that is, other things wrong with them. So patients who perhaps needed heart surgery in order to live were turned down by some heart surgeons who said, you know, go elsewhere, or sometimes they couldn't go elsewhere and they just died in a way that maintained the positive metrics, the positive scores on the scorecard of the surgeons, but at the expense of the people who didn't get operated on. That's one form that this took. Then this 30-day standard that is for certain major procedures, the standard of success is whether the patient lives for 30 days. That can also have, and does frequently have, perverse consequences, because the surgeon in question, even if the operation isn't successful, and I've been told this by people who manage surgery units at major hospitals, they'll get pressure from surgeons to keep the patient alive for 31 days.
You're describing the entire universe is like something out of Catch 22, or where it's just madness heaped on top of madness, and you know the measurements just keep getting changed in order to feed a system that seems increasingly divorced from actual reality. If I may, you had mentioned Robert McNamara before, the defense secretary during. Robert McNamara is a great case study in failing upwards from running Ford during the Edsel years, then the Vietnam War during its worst, bleakest period, and then the World Bank. Explain how Robert McNamara is kind of like the patron saint of the tyranny of metrics, isn't he?
Yes. Well, McNamara was a very bright professor of accounting at Harvard Business School. He was, I believe, the youngest tenured professor ever at Harvard Business School at the age of 28. And he brought this accounting mentality to whatever he touched. So he brought it, he was hired by Ford Motors in the 1950s. And then, as you say, in the Kennedy-Johnson years, he was the Secretary of Defense. And he brought this metric mentality to the Department of Defense. So they kept greater and greater track of things in Vietnam, like the number of sorties that were flown, which is actually an example of keeping track of a process rather than an outcome. They wanted to find some kind of measurement of outcome, so they chose body counts. That is to say, the notion was to take the number of enemies that were killed in battle compared to the number of your own that were killed in battle, and if the enemy number went up high enough, then presumably the enemy was going to lose and you were going to win. Well, that created all kinds of dysfunctions. And then there was a reward and punishment tied in, because the prospects of officers being promoted by McNamara were tied in part to these body count metrics. So it created a number of perverse incentives. The worst, I suppose, is that in some cases, people actually went out and killed innocent civilians in order to raise the body count. Secondly, the the officers often fudged or distorted the data to increase their chances of promotion, but in a way that made the body count seem higher than it was. And last but not least, some soldiers were actually killed because after a battle, they were sent into the battlefield to count the bodies, and in the process, they got shot by enemy snipers.
Yeah.
So, and the worst part of it was that the body count was actually not a very good proxy for what one really wanted to know, namely whether the enemy was going to surrender.
Right.
In other words, the hearts and minds of the Vietnamese, of the North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong. So in all of those ways, McNamara's tenure at the Department of Defense exemplified a lot of these patterns of metric fixation, and he instituted a whole culture in the Department of Defense that was more and more oriented towards accounting rather than strategy.
Well, and you know, I was taken in reading your book, and you even in this conversation, you've come back to the idea of, you know, there are kind of numbers or metrics versus mm-hmm. judgment and expertise, which cannot be reduced to a series of techniques. And, you know, to go back to Hayek, there's a you know, you place a lot of importance on a kind of tacit knowledge or things that are particular to a particular culture, to a particular business, to a particular practice. Is there a great, or I guess you would agree, there is a great evacuation of the idea of expertise that is tied to specific times and places. And it's more, we want to believe in this kind of universal system where you can just parachute in and, like, as long as you've been trained in the right way from the right business school or whatever, you can do well in any situation. What do you think is driving that kind of diminution of respect for earned expertise in a particular time and place?
Some of it has to do with the factors that we mentioned earlier. Mm-hmm. The decline of trust means in some ways a decline of trust in expertise.
Right.
There are institutions like business schools and consultancies that have an incentive to embrace this kind of culture of managerialism, right? That you're going to hire the consultants because this is what they know how to do. They know how to institute the right metrics, so they're more likely to embrace it. And then there's a propensity of people who have been successful in fields that are highly metric driven, like finance, to take those same sort of propensities and apply them elsewhere. So one finds this, for example, increasingly in philanthropy, in places like the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. You know, these are people who made a lot of money, and they made it in good part, by a successful use of metrics and measured performance, and they pride themselves on that, and then they bring that set of cultural references, that set of mm-hmm. how things ought to be evaluated, to bear in their philanthropy, so that the philanthropies are increasingly oriented towards that which is measurable. And that which is measurable in philanthropy often turns out to be things that are more tangible but more short-term. So that's part of it too.
Mm-hmm. Can I? You have sections on things like policing, which is really fascinating, and you mm-hmm. you know, you complicate the scenario by which things like CompStat and other programs may or may not have been tracking crime correctly. Mm-hmm. You talk about all sorts of other areas. I want to ask you about business and finance, which you mentioned in passing. You know, many libertarians, a lot of the stuff we've been talking about are kind of public sector things. And so we're predisposed as libertarians to be like, oh, yeah, well, the public sector and maybe even philanthropy and certainly foreign aid, which you go into. Well, those mm-hmm. are, you know, those are kind of bullshit mm-hmm. things that can be easily gamed. But you take the private sector to the woodshed as well. How has the tyranny of metrics screwed up things like business and finance?
Well, in a variety of ways. And by the way, this is one of the ways in which I think it's important when you're dealing with a thinker like Hayek to take his insights about the nature of knowledge and the dispersed nature of knowledge and the limits of scientism and so on, and to apply them in areas that he himself may not have applied them to. So for ideological reasons, he was predisposed to apply these things, these critiques, to his critique of socialist planning and so mm-hmm. on, which I think he was absolutely right about. But some of the same problems of scientism occur within private business organizations. And some of these problems of metric fixation certainly occur within business organizations, in part because of the way in which incentives there are structured. To take a couple of very concrete examples and then a more general one, you know, a few years ago, Mylan, the drug manufacturer, got into tremendous trouble because they hired a set of because the board of Mylan hired a set of executives and set up a structure of incentives where if the profitability of the firm increased rapidly, I think it was 16% a year, the top executives in the firm were going to get huge bonuses, which indeed they did. One of the ways they did that was by taking a more or less generic product of which they bought the rights to be the sole manufacturer, which was the EpiPen. Mm-hmm. And they publicized the utility of the EpiPen. This is something that's used to combat allergic shock by giving people a shot of epinephrine, hence the term EpiPen. It's very useful. People who have kids who have, or adults, who are subject to these kinds of allergic shocks, typically wanted to have more than one of these pens. They wanted to have one in school and one at home and so on. So they advertised it broadly, and then they began jacking up the price from about $100 to about $400. And then as this new system of executive incentives kicked in, they jacked it up to over $600. Now, they hadn't changed the product in the least. And this was a product that was in ever greater demand because people were now aware of its utility. But they were jacking up the price in a way that was affecting more and more consumers, especially the parents of children who had these allergies. And that led to a huge outcry against the company, led to senatorial investigations, and essentially ruined the reputation of the company and as a result sent the stock price way down. So that's a way in which the structure of misconceived incentives in a private organization connected with this metric fixation can have these very negative outcomes. Or then in the case of Wells Fargo Bank, which had a whole panoply of these kinds of policies, but one of them was that lower-level people in the bank were instructed that when customers opened new accounts, they were supposed to try to upsell them for other kinds of services that were more profitable to the bank, like credit cards and opening additional accounts and so on. And they were told, the lower-level employees of the bank were told that if they didn't do this, they were going to be penalized. They were going to have longer hours or they were going to lose their job. So a lot of them responded by opening fake accounts in the name of these customers in order to obviate the punishment created by this metric fixation. That, in turn, that was one of the things that ruined the reputation of that bank, and it's still trying to recover from it. And then, of course, there's the whole issue of the 2008 financial crisis, which certainly had many causes, but some of them had to do with the attempt to replace concrete knowledge of concrete assets like mortgages, like whether someone could actually afford to buy a house, with standardized mathematized formulas of grouping all these mortgages together, mortgages that were increasingly given to people who didn't have demonstrable revenue, selling those groups of mortgages, dividing them mathematically into tranches that were supposed to represent different levels of risk, creating these consolidated debt obligations and so on. All of this had to do with ever greater use of metrics and mathematics and ever greater removal from the concrete, that is, who's actually able to pay for these mortgages. And that was not the only factor, right, but it was certainly one of the factors that worked its way into the financial crisis of 2008.
You know, you have a great line. This is from the section on education, but I found it a very striking insight, particularly for libertarians to consider. You say, a capitalist society depends for its flourishing on a variety of institutions that provide a counterweight to the market, with its focus on monetary gain. Can you expand on that a little bit? And how does that fit into this, you know, kind of the larger framework that you're talking about?
I wrote that primarily in the chapter having to do with universities and higher education. So there's this propensity now, not just among libertarians, but all sorts of legislators from both sides of the political divide, and not just in the United States, one finds this in many European countries as well, to think about higher education purely in terms of return on investment. That is to say, how much is college going to cost the student or his parents, and how much is it then going to increase their earning power when they come out? Well, earning a living is an important part of life. And college has gotten more and more expensive. Those things are certainly true. And for a variety of reasons that I deal with in the book, lots of people are encouraged to go to college who probably aren't prepared for college. But when you think about college just in terms of return on investment, you leave out many of the potentially most valuable elements of college. So it's possibility of expanding one's imagination, expanding one's appreciation of so many elements of life, from biology to economics to art to music. You leave out the whole social aspect of education, the friendships that are made, the fact that if you keep your eyes open and you're wise about this, you may very well find your marital partner at your college. All of those are ways that enrich one's life in the long run that don't manifest themselves in an increase in one's salary or earning capacity, but to think about these things purely in terms of market return is an undue narrowing of human possibilities and makes people's lives poorer, even though they may or may not earn more. If you don't know what it means, if you're not inclined to go to an art gallery because art doesn't mean anything to you, or you're not inclined to go to a jazz concert because the whole idea of theme and variations is something you've never been taught, or the human body is kind of, sort of uninteresting to you because you haven't thought about the wonders of how it works, if you haven't made friendships because you were just focused on the studies that were going to, the parts of your studies that were going to increase your income. All of those in the long run make your life poorer. That's what I meant.
Yeah, and obviously you've drunk deep at the, I don't want to say trough, but I guess at the well of Arnold, Matthew Arnold, and you know, the function of a liberal education to really enhance and increase the ability to appreciate existence in all of its forms. You know, you mentioned marriage, meeting people at college and getting married, but you devote a chapter to the idea that transparency and kind of metric fixation can be the enemy of performance, and in things such as politics, diplomacy, intelligence, and marriage. What do you mean by that? Shouldn't
sure, if they
married
want to get
people
divorced,
be telling everything to each other?
Or to put it another way, look, the whole concept of intimacy is based on the fact that there are some things that we share with others with whom we are close. If we shared everything all the time with everybody, we wouldn't have intimate relations. Now, even with those with whom we have intimate personal relations, like hopefully our spouses, it would probably be counterproductive for them to know everything that's going on in your mind, some of which would be off-putting for them.
Yeah. And you talk about how in politics, too, that in a way, I mean, we want to hold our politicians accountable for the outcomes of things. But you make the case, or at least to suggest the case, that knowing, being involved, like if every meeting is subject to a kind of surveillance camera or a sunshine law, they're not going to make deals in the same way that might end up actually creating better laws, and that we should be focused on the outcomes.
Absolutely.
Not
and there I draw
process.
Heavily on the work of Jonathan Rauch, who's written very powerfully about this. And
right. Contributor to reason, certainly. And it struck me in general, that whole issue about transparency and whatnot, again, is very Hayekian. Hayek at various points says, you know, we need these closed off private spaces. He was a critic of Rousseau and Rousseau's dream of a kind of universal transparency in all parts of the universe. For Hayek, and actually even somebody like Michel Foucault, I mean, I find this fascinating, the way that you're working out, you know, the idea that there are no private places means that we really can't kind of get away from the world and create ourselves in any meaningful way.
That's a part of Hayek I'll have to revisit. It doesn't come to mind immediately.
Yeah. As a final topic of discussion, what are some handy, you provide a checklist at the end of the book, but, you know, give me three or four things that we should, because again, you're not against measurement, you're not against metrics, but what are some basic things that we can do to mistakes to avoid so that we don't tyrannize ourselves
so one
with
of them,
measurement?
The first I would say has to do with the input to the metrics. If the input comes from people who are knowledgeable about the field, who have experience in it, who have expertise in it, they will have a better sense of what kinds of things to measure and what kinds of things not to measure and what kinds of things, and here's where the judgment part comes in, what kinds of things are important that can't be measured, like cooperation, mentoring, and so on. So first of all, formulate the metrics using input from people with experience and expertise. Secondly, this is really very essential, I think, to understand this distinction. There's a big difference between metrics that are used for diagnosis by practitioners themselves versus metrics that are shown to third parties for purposes of reward and punishment. So if, for example, two surgical units of a hospital or of two different hospitals where the surgical units are doing essentially the same thing, if they can compare their metrics of safety, for example, of the level of infection in the surgical unit, and then they see on the basis of that that one is doing better than the other, then the one that is doing better from the other can instruct the unit that's doing less well about what they're doing that has more positive outcomes. So if the metrics are really valuable when they're used for diagnosis by the practitioners themselves, as opposed to saying metrics that are sent to the Center on Medicare and Medicaid Services that are then going to reward or punish that surgical unit based on the metrics. When they're used by the practitioners themselves for diagnosis, then you don't have those incentives for gaming. As I say, the question of who uses it and who the metrics are shown to, the question of input and the role of practitioners in and people with expertise in the input, and then the role of those with expertise and experience in judging how much weight to give to the things that are measured compared to the things that are not. All of those are factors that make for the positive use of metrics as opposed to the dysfunctional use of them.
All right. Well, we're going to leave it there. We have been talking with Jerry Z. Mueller, who teaches at Catholic University, and he's the author, most recently, of The Tyranny of Metrics. Jerry, thanks so much for talking to Reason.
My pleasure.
This has been the Reason Podcast. I've been your host, Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to us at Apple, at Google, at Spotify, at SoundCloud, at Reason.com, or wherever you get your podcasts, and rate and review us when you can. Thanks for listening.